So I'd like to start by introducing our MC, Helen. So Helen Oakey is the CEO of Renew, who do some amazing work, which I'll let Helen elaborate on. She's worked in sustainability, climate advocacy and community engagement for more than 20 years. So we're in really great hands tonight with her running the show. As a policy advisor in the ACT Parliament, she saw the Territory set its 100% renewable energy target. Later as Executive Director of the ACT's Peak Environment Organisation, she led the successful campaign for a gas-free ACT, adopted by the ACT Government in 2022, and developed Make the Switch, a website helping Canberra households transition off gas. I'm proud to say Helen is also now a local girl, so she's an Nillumbik local, and also that she puts her money where her mouth is and that she's had experience fully electrifying a three-bedroom cottage in Canberra and more recently a two-bedroom townhouse in Eltham. So she really knows how it works in practice. So please join me in welcoming Helen.
Thanks so much, Natalie. Can you hear me? Everyone hear me okay? Great, thank you. So I'm so excited to see you all here tonight. This is my new home away from Canberra. 25 years in Canberra and nearly three in Eltham, so it's just starting to feel like home. So it's really exciting to meet with all the local climate and energy activists as well and do some work with them. So thank you, Natalie, for the opportunity. I can talk a little bit about Renew, but I'm going to keep it very brief because it's not why we're here tonight. But Renew is a Victorian-based organisation, 45 years old this year, and we work on empowering communities to make their homes more sustainable. And we've been doing that work for a very long time. And in fact, it was Renew that inspired me originally to look at the costs and the benefits of getting off gas and electrifying houses. So we do publish Renew magazine and Sanctuary magazine, which you'll see out in the foyer. And if you would like to subscribe, they make a fabulous Christmas present to get a subscription for the sustainably minded person in your life. So if you'd like to do that, you can pop out afterwards. But I'm actually here to talk about Sol's book. So thank you for coming this evening. And obviously the purpose of the evening is to help help Sol launch his book, Plug In, the Electrification Handbook, which I'm now going to give to him. You can all get a shot. So Sol is an engineer, an inventor, an advocate for a fairer energy system, MacArthur Genius Award recipient, which we might ask him about later, and, of course, an author. Plug In is his fourth book on electrification and his most practical yet. So this is the one that tells you how to do it. His first book, Electrifier, was a love letter to the incoming Biden administration focused on the American energy system. And his next two books, The Big Switch and The Wires That Bind, I like that, that was very clever, The Wires That Bind, brought those ideas home to Australia, setting out how we could raise our policy ambition here. It was through writing these two books that Sol co-founded Rewiring America and Rewiring Australia. Not-for-profit organisations that are dedicated to turning electrification from a policy idea into a real plan. Sol wanted to not just write about what governments and households should do, but to build organisations that show governments how and why to invest in electrification. In the US, this work helped shape the Inflation Reduction Act, driving massive clean energy investment. And here in Australia, we're starting to see progress with programs like the Cheaper Home Batteries Program, which is the one that gives you the 30% rebate on your batteries, and the Home Energy Upgrades Fund, which is the low-interest loans that banks are now offering. Sol's latest book, Plug In, focuses on the practical choices households can make now and over the next 15 years to electrify, save on energy bills, do their bit to reduce climate impacts, and set Australia up for the clean energy transition that is already underway. So it's now my great pleasure to pitch some questions at Sol. But what we're going to do is I'm going to run through some questions that I've got for Sol that we've been working on with Rewiring Australia a little bit as well. But at the end of that, there's going to be an opportunity for you to ask questions. So if there's things that I don't touch on, or even during, if you're really busting to ask a question during the conversation, then please feel free to put your hand up. That makes it a little bit more complicated logistically, but we'll manage. And if there's anything that I don't touch on, then please save it up for the end, and we're going to spend a good 20 minutes asking questions at the end. Sol's also promised to sign your books for you if you come and grab one afterwards, with love letters to all of you about electrification.
Yes.
Okay, so I think when I read this book, and I know what Sol's journey is, and I've been watching him, you know, I'm sure all of you have seen him in the media and talking about this issue. He often talks about electrification as five very simple things that you should be doing in your home. And I guess the question is, you know, it's really clear that we're in a difficult situation with climate change. So is it really just as simple as five things that you should be doing in your home? And what is the role that you see of householders in shaping this clean energy system that we need to have going forward?
Just before we get to that, I want to address the genius issue. So I grew up in Australia, well aware of the tall poppy syndrome, and it's not actually called the MacArthur Genius Award. It's called the MacArthur Fellowship, and it came out this week. But you can't push against the tide, and so colloquially it's known as the MacArthur Genius Award. But if you have a wife like mine, once you are called a genius and
there's no letting it down.
Yeah, you open the cupboard. You know, you're tall, you open the cupboard, and then you walk into it for the next 5 minutes, the edge. She's like, genius. Nice job, genius. Yeah, you get the picture. So I'm still paying for that, which is a problem. So to come back to your question, so is it as easy as just five things? And is it urgent? Well, it's absolutely urgent. The just five things framing, which is really the context for this book, and maybe to introduce this book. So Electrify was, in theory, if you could get solar to $1 a watt and you electrify all the things, by 2025 it'll be cost effective. And that was what we were pushing, and that's the policy work in the US was to try and make that true. That hasn't turned out to be true in America, and in fact, electricity is getting more expensive in America in a way that's making the agenda harder. The wires, the bind, and the big switch were like, oh, Australia's really, really close to this, and wouldn't it be good? And actually, the wires, the bind is about how it helps the economics of the community. Maybe we'll come back to that. And then the publisher's like, I really want you to write one more book, but I want it to be... you know, the first one was for presidents, then like thought leaders, and then community leaders. Can we write the Electrify for tradies? Which I thought was really hard, and I didn't want to do it for a minute. And then I was like, actually, I should do this. And I interviewed a bunch of people for the book who are actual real practitioners. In fact, one of them's here in the audience tonight. So we're actually looking at, you know, what are the things that you can do in your household. And so the idea here was, I want you to panic about climate change. It is really urgent. And then I want you to make five good decisions over the next 10 years. And that really means that the next time your water heater goes, and that's what Carl, I interviewed him for that. When next time your water heater goes, replace it with an electric one, preferably a heat pump. The next time your old Volvo kicks the bucket, replace it with an electric car. So two decisions. The next time your space heating gas goes out, replace it with a heat pump for heating. The next time your kitchen stove goes out, replace it with an induction stove or an electric stove. And then make sure you buy clean electricity, which is solar and batteries and the other things. So they're the five decisions. And if every Australian made those five decisions over the next 10 or 15 years, which is actually the rate at which we naturally replace these things in our lives anyway, we actually could get the portion of our economy, which is our households, to zero emissions quite easily by 2040. So, and that is commensurate with a 2-degree warming target. If everyone in the world did that, we would actually probably beat 2 degrees. Globally, the portion of those these are what you call the kitchen table decisions. 42% of emissions in the US are those five decisions. In Australia, it's 42% of our domestic economy, which means everything except for all the energy we use to dig up fossil fuels and export them. So it looks like it's a smaller portion in Australia, but it's actually roughly the same portion of our domestic life, because 40% of Australia's energy use is focused on exports. It's also the kitchen table decisions also extend to small business. And if you included, so it's the same set of decisions, you know, what vehicles your small business are using, what you cook with in your small businesses, how you heat them, how you power them. And that's roughly another 25 to 30% of any nation's emissions. So actually you kind of solve 70% of the climate problem with those five decisions for households and small businesses. So it is very meaningful. But then, you know, it doesn't solve long-haul aviation and transportation, agriculture, food, or industry. So that's the remaining things. But it is the things that we as people have agency over, so that's why I emphasize it. And then this book is sort of the victory lap. Electrify was the theoretical. The first chapter here is actually about a lovely man called Chris Kerr, who lives on the south coast of New South Wales. He made all these five decisions starting during COVID, and he tells this great story. So he's got four kids, so it's a high energy household in every possible sense. He initially did it for the economics. He got a $1,500 electricity bill, and he's like, "That's terrible. I'm going to do something about it." And because it was COVID, he'd cancelled his holiday to Bali with the kids, so he had enough money to buy the biggest solar system that he could instead. It was total dad math. I'm guilty of the same stuff. And then he found that he had way more electricity than he needed, so then he electrified everything to absorb this very cheap solar energy that he had. Anyway, he was in it for the return on investment. He over-optimized, let's call it, the hot water heater. His wife had a cold shower. He realized that there was another incentive in the house, which was the return on comfort. And then he realized that the things that he was doing, like, you know, getting the hot water heater in the kitchen right, was actually improving air quality and the comfort of the house. And then because he's got four modern Australian kids, they were representing for climate. And so really this book is the recognition that in Australia we can go full speed now, because none of these, you can be doing it for any of these reasons. You can be doing it for the money, you can be doing it for the climate, you can be doing it for health and comfort. It's a win here. And we're one of the first countries in the world, largely because of our really cheap rooftop solar, where that is true. And so then the other part of this book is like calling on the tradies to be the heroes of our climate movement now, because like we've done our job. Now it's about rolling as many white utes out as possible full of the things that electrify Australia.
So the tradie debate is an interesting one. I mean, when this conversation started 10 years ago, there were less people who knew what it was all about. Why do you think that tradies have been a difficult audience to reach in some regards? And is that changing now? Are we seeing that shift, or are we having more informed conversations? I mean, I remember back in Canberra that, you know, every plumber that you got over would tell you that a heat pump wouldn't work in a cold climate, even though they were made for Germany and it's cold in Germany. because, you know, some of those things were rolled out and they weren't particularly good, and, you know, the reputation at the time took a hit. Is that changing?
It is changing, and I actually did a podcast with a tradie in Noosa, and he and all of his crews were all in, and finally we have a set of tradespeople that are selling in favour of the solutions. In his words, he's like, there's still a lot of yeah, nah tradies, which is the yeah, nah, you want, yeah, I got a cheap gas one in the back of the truck. So that generation that, you know, smokes Benson and Hedges, they're on the way up. And it looks like the younger tradies are doing it. Not all of them, not yet. And, you know, we're probably short 40 or 50,000 tradies to get this job done if we're going to do it by 2040 or 2050.
Are you optimistic that by the time we get, like, another 5 years down the track, that most of our tradies will be on board with this?
I think we could certainly afford to invest more in them. The Electrical Trades Union is doing a good job, but they're more for industrial electricians, but they're totally getting them on board and on the program. I'd like to see it done more at the starting at apprentice level. So that's something Australia could invest in.
And, I mean, I guess with getting off gas and electrifying, the incentives to doing so, as you said, are threefold, maybe fourfold: cost, health and comfort, and the climate. Do you think it was an important time to be able to have a conversation about positive change that wasn't just about climate and that actually allowed people to feel a bit more empowered about making good decisions in the context of, you know, successive governments that potentially haven't made very good decisions. Well, I shouldn't say potentially. I'll raise the flag. Successive governments that haven't made good decisions on climate change in Australia.
I think this tour has been, a lot of my friends are like, why are you going on a book tour and talking to 200 people at a time? And I was like, I actually think it's really important to hear what audiences want. And so far what I'm hearing is people are very frustrated that successive governments haven't been ambitious enough, that we're not getting a good deal for the investments we're making. So the way our tariffs and the electricity market is designed doesn't really fully reward us for our contributions to Australia's infrastructure in terms of, you know, we still guarantee the returns of AGL, yet we won't guarantee your returns for your infrastructure investments. So that would be, I think, if we were truly trying to design a fair energy system, we would put more power into the Australian household. We don't even have representation on the main regulatory bodies, right? AEMO, which is meant to design the system, is a partnership only between the generators and the government. Doesn't include the retailers, definitely doesn't include us. Australian Energy Regulator, I believe the Australian public should have voting positions on the boards of all of these organisations, because the reality is we will be the largest generator collectively. Our rooftops will be the largest battery, with the batteries on the side of our homes and in our driveways. So if we're a huge portion of our infrastructure, we should have much better say in how the electricity market is designed. So I hear that, versions of that complaint coming from the audiences, and everyone knows that climate is urgent and wants to go faster. And what's really amazing is, you know, I never thought that you'd be able to speak to 100 to 500 Australians on a Monday night, day after day, about climate and electrification, but actually people are showing up. You guys are showing up. It finally feels like we have a practically minded, get it done, we'll do what we can ourselves, and we'll make the demands of government sort of climate movement, and it's showing up and turning out, and that's amazing.
I have a friend who says that we should no longer rely on governments to actually deliver the solutions for us, that we actually need to deliver the solutions ourselves. This is a wonderful way of doing that on this issue, really, and taking back that power. I remember 20 years ago we used to talk about a decentralised energy system, and we've actually kind of created it. It's here. So, well, it's almost here. It can get bigger.
Well, I think that's how, you know, if we're honest, the best governments throughout history have been the governments that have risen out of people's discontent, and I think it's happening in Australia in a good way. I'm hoping that we can replicate this type of turnout in America. I think that was what needs to happen there if they want to do the things that will make that energy system work better. But I'm investing more heavily in Australia right now because, you know, we're here first, the economics works. I think our latest numbers are roughly every Australian household saves $4,500 a year. If this is extraordinary, if everyone ran on that 5-point plan, so by 2040 the whole country is electric, we'd save $1 trillion in energy costs by then as a nation. Right, so the Sky News headline that the transition is going to cost us couldn't be more absurd. It's just going to save us for days. And that's the fairer part of the tour. So if you can arrive at this college on a Monday night, you can probably afford to do this, but fairer is we don't solve climate change unless we get every household in Australia. So how do we actually now demand the policy of government that extends it beyond this room so that every Australian can afford this transition?
So I'd like to pick up on that around some of the people in the community who may not be able to step into this space straight away. And obviously that'll include people who've got either low income, potentially low levels of cash in the bank, so no free capital, and people who are renting as well. What are the things that you think Australian policymakers should be doing in order to support the electrification transition and make it accessible to everybody?
The top 5% of Australian households can pay cash to buy the goodies, and they wouldn't even notice it, and then they'd be saving $5,000 or $10,000 a year. So the higher income your household, the more energy you use, the more you'll save.
Which is a bit ironic, isn't it? Because we know that some of the highest postcode high-income postcodes are actually have some of the lowest solar.
This is also
installation
true.
Levels.
I think the reality. I think if you look at the numbers by decile, so each 20% of the population, for the top 20% of Australian households, your energy costs are about 3% of your spend, which probably means you're spending more on alcohol than energy. Someone's honest. And for the bottom 20% of households, it's 9 or 10%, in which case you're sweating it and you're sweating making those payments with the rent. So I think that's a really simple representation of it. The storytelling version is the single mum in the outer suburbs of Melbourne who's got a job at a hospital in Melbourne is commuting 60 k's each way. She would be saving $3,000 or $4,000 a year, which is like a pizza meal a week that she doesn't have to cook if she had an electric car. But the husband's left with her credit score and she's got no chance of getting in on this economic windfall. So I have a few of those types of sort of caricatures or stereotypes, for want of a better word, for like that's what we need to solve for. You take something like the Home Energy Upgrade Fund, sounds great. They run it through the CEFC, but the CEFC literally just is a backstop for the banks that use the traditional rules of Australian banking, meaning you can only have this loan if your credit score is this high. And so it's not really doing anything to help. The battery rebate is great, but you still have to have $7,000 to buy the $10,000 battery, and that's not so, you know, it looks like. And Australians love a good rort, and we love middle-class welfare. So it's very popular, but it's not helping lowering the energy bills. So I think we're still actually creating we're still at risk of exacerbating the culture war because we're not helping the poorest Australians. What I would really like to see is big nation-building policy that looks like finance packages, and there's Rewiring Australia is an advocate for something called the Electrify Everything Loan Scheme, which is sort of a long-term low-interest loan against the properties. And the day every Australian feels the richest is when you sell your property, so you pay it back then. We could do things like that. That would be the cheapest way to do it. There's other mechanisms.
Which is actually similar to what the ACT have done, isn't it? Because they put a $10,000 loan in and it's no interest. So it's something that you can pay back later.
Yep. And I think ACT is good policy. There's some little minor programs in Victoria that are good policy. I think there's a whole bunch of ways we can do it. But you'll know the country is serious not when it sounds like middle class welfare, but when it sounds nation building, like something accessible to everyone. And that, it doesn't have a great name right now, but HEX was just such a program 30 or 40 years ago. We in Australia invented that. And I think we are capable of doing this. We've done modelling with Treasury. It pays for itself. So I think we need to do that as soon as possible if we're going to make it fair. Question in the back.
Our focus has been on solar panels previously. Should we now be looking at solar panels and batteries to maximise the ROI on our investments?
I'll try and rephrase it. Just the audio is a bit odd. So I've forgotten.
Daniela
is a property lawyer and runs an org that got a grant for about $100,000 from a benefactor that they used to do small $10,000 loans to low-income people to get solar. And they have found that all those people were able to pay back those loans because you save more than you spend. That's the fundamental thing. So that's a really important point, is these things now pay for themselves, so we shouldn't be limiting who has access. And then her question was, they're succeeding at their little program. What should they be doing now? Should they be doing solar and a battery as the next thing? And I think if you just looked at the raw numbers, the electric vehicle is where you save the most money. So of the $4,500, so the average Australian home is 2.7 people. and so the 2.7 people, they have 1.8 cars. They'll save the most money to electrify one of the cars. Then the next biggest saver is the solar. The biggest saver after that is probably just the electric water heater running around the clock. And I'm disappointed. Australian Labor is still very scared of the "You'll Ruin the Weekend" headline. And so very much averse to subsidising electric vehicles in any way or helping. I would have loved if their next policy, like the home battery rebate program, was focused on vehicles, because that would produce the bigger savings. I've heard the statistic that 20% of Australian cars do 50% of Australian kilometres. So you could target this, you find the people with the long commutes, and that would be best possible thing you could do for emissions, best possible thing you could do for pocketbooks. And I applaud your program, and I love that orgs are doing it, but we need to make we need to get government to, it needs to be 10 million, not 10. Which is not a criticism. Thanks for the work.
Renters. What do we need to do for renters? Does the incentives big enough so the landlords are happy to put them in?
Honestly, I think you've got to split the renter landlord incentive. I think you give the tax break to the landlord and you give the break on the savings. You compel the landlord to pass through the savings on energy through to the renter, and you've got to figure out mechanisms to do that. I think Victoria, correct me if I'm wrong, just put out a policy that you can demand that your landlord put solar on your roof if the landlord can only deny you if it's technically not possible or historically.
I haven't heard that one yet.
I hope I'm not leaking draft policy.
Well, they did just release the minimum standards for renters, which mean that you can demand ceiling insulation and also cooling. And the cooling's quite powerful in this debate, because if you have energy efficient cooling, you effectively have your energy efficient heating.
Yep.
So that's the win. That's the sneaky win. And a few other things, but I haven't heard that bit.
And just to continue leaking the policy, I also heard that the government would finance the landlord in the situation. So that seemed like there was a way to compel the landlord to do it, make sure that they have finance and pass the savings on to the renter. I think there's a whole bunch of solutions for renters. Honestly, just as with my answer to the previous question, the way renters will save the most money is helping them to get electric cars. Part of the problem is our rental stock of homes are going to probably, at the way we're doing it today, they're going to be the last places where you can charge your vehicle. So we need to think about that as well.
Too close to that microphone.
We have the most precarious chairs up here, just so you know. We're both terrified.
Sitting very, very delicately on the edge, leaning forward. I just want to go back to a little bit about what you've been doing in the last few years around in Thirroul with Electrify 2515. Can you tell everybody a little bit about what that project is and what you're trying to achieve and how's it going? Because you've got a while to go, but how far through are you?
So I moved here in 2020, and we were working on the IRA. That was my nightlife because of the time zone.
The
Inflation Reduction Act. Oh, yeah. I may also be a terrorist, but no, it was climate policy. Terribly named policy, I think, by design. But then the realisation was we need to make this exist in one community somewhere, right? You'd like the future that people can touch. And I had fantasised that we would do a sort of a lighthouse community. And there's a very good technical reason to do it. So the whole world built its grid in the early 20th century, and they built it in very similar ways. And so the grid anywhere in the world looks roughly, you know, I'm a mathematician sometimes, so topographically the same. It means sort of roughly a substation, which is, you know, there'll be one behind the railway tracks out here somewhere. It's a pretty ugly looking thing, but that substation probably serves on average 5,000 homes on what they call five feeders. So if you look up at the utility poles, there's three wires on top and there's four wires underneath. The three wires are on top are the medium voltage, so the 11,000 volts that comes from the substation. And then the four wires beneath are at 240 that comes to your house. I wanted to show that one substation with really high penetration of solar, really high penetration of electric vehicles, all of the household electrification wouldn't break the grid. Because you remember in 2020, everyone saying, oh, yeah, nah, it won't work, it'll break the grid. We need nuclear and coal for base load. Base load, by the way, was invented as a, it was a problem that coal created. You can't turn coal off in less than half a day. So it became base load because you can't turn it off. And so we even changed shifts and invented loads in the middle of the night, like Las Vegas, to absorb to absorb the thing. So just to show that it works, and so it was initially it was a technical project, but we had to get penetration. So we wanted to do 500 homes because that was half of a feeder and enough that you would see statistically what it's doing and that you could hold it all together and keep the phases and the voltages and all the things that people would like to say are going to fail. We needed $20 million to do that, but again, Australian government didn't want to help us do cars, so the cars were counted out of the program, so then we're limited to doing homes. So the ambition isn't quite what I wanted, but the result has been fascinating. I think we won before we even started, honestly, because it changed the debate. We're like, we can do it, and we are going to do it in one place. And it got us a lot of political power. It got us heard. Like, we were able to show that roughly 40% of our community said they're willing to sign up and join. And just that fact alone changed. Politicians are like, really? Nearly half of a community wants to do this? That's meaningful. So we moved the politics a little. In fact, Chris Bowen has recently announced that he would like to do 7 to 10 more of these things to focus on new problems like strata or renters or vehicle charging. There's still things.
Or really cold climate.
We're pretty cold in the shadow of the escarpment. but we should be, the country can afford to do it, and we should be doing it. What we've really learned is a lot of what they call social license. Even 3 or 4 years ago, there's a lot of skepticism. I think everyone's had 5 or 10 too many solar advertisements on their phone per day. And so this almost, we've tuned it out. We don't trust the salespeople. And what's happened in our community is, I swim every day in our swimming pool, and a day doesn't go past now where somebody's like, so which heat pump, which water heater, do you like this brand of solar, which EV? And you can kind of, you really realise that this is going to be a trust issue for Australians, and there is a lot of social permission that your neighbours are doing it. Part of the reason we have the highest penetration of solar in the world is, you'd say, your neighbour's got that new thing on the roof. What's that, mate? And it's like, cheap electricity. Who installed it? Oh, Tom. Oh, what's his number? So we have really, we've got that effect now working for more than just solar. It's the whole electrification kit.
And has there been any impact on the local area grid infrastructure that you've had to manage? Or what does that look like at the moment?
We are... I can't even remember what I'm allowed to say and not say anymore. The local network engineers are following the project closely, and we're working with them. Endeavour is our local DNSP, and they've assigned more resources, and we're having to upgrade a few things. And actually, we're looking now at deploying first-in-the-world technology that means... So you when people say the grid won't handle it, what they mean is the sine wave of the grid, the 50 hertz, the low hum when your toaster's not working right, that historically comes from what they call the spinning generator, a giant spinning wheel that spins literally at that frequency at the coal plant or the gas plant, and that's the inertia that holds up the grid. The reality is that, so when they say it won't work, the fear is that won't work. But the reality is our inverters now are good enough that they can generate this system strength and this inertia from the bottom up. And so we're going to be doing that probably for the first time on our local grid and showing that, in fact, we are really, it used to just be a headline. We are the infrastructure. We literally will be the infrastructure setting the phase for the grid. There's a question here.
The question is, you can't buy an electric car because there's no chargers out there. What are your thoughts on that? I'm repeating that for the recording and for you to have some thinking time.
I was on another thought, and I'm going to... So anyway, we are doing, we're making the grid work in a new way up there now. So it's fully involved, and to Endeavour's credit, they're really leaning in. And in fact, to the point on vehicle charges, we've got, they're deploying new and experimental vehicle charges in the community. I'm not sure exactly what Carl's question is. There are now all sorts of vehicle charges that, you know, the cars mostly come with one that's good enough to just trickle charge. You get the best economics if you just use the local one. You can now get, for some of the vehicles, the vehicle to load and the vehicle to grid is actually happening. Is this the, can you be more nuanced with your question, Carl? Yeah, everyone's got a PowerPoint in the garage, and honestly, if you talk to the people in the book, and this is in the book, the people who've owned electric vehicles for 4 or 5 years, the vehicle changes you a little bit. And it turns out everyone realizes after they've had the car for 3 months that the cheapest way to run it is to charge it low and slow, literally off, just opportunistically when you're, like your phone, and that works really well. The faster charges are coming and the vehicle to grid is coming. Just to repeat that question, really short, I've had an electric car for 2 years, love charging at home, that totally works. I'm a bit scared of driving it to Adelaide. And is there intention from the government to get involved in vehicle charging? I think there is ample room for the government to get really involved. I looked last week, somebody sent me a photograph from Norway, and it just looks like a public street. And there's a 3-foot-high pole at every parking spot on the street, and every single car on the street is hooked up doing low and slow charging. I think we need to do things like that. I think we need more in the regional network, although I just drove successfully to basically Fraser Island and back from Wollongong and first time I had no problems finding spaces, so we're getting there. But the government is leaning on the private sector to install them. I think to get into truly regional Australia, the government has to lean in. But the real point to make is when we electrify the vehicles in our households, we're going to triple the electricity the household needs, double to triple. And what really is going to make the grid crash is if we have the idea that everyone's going to get home at 6 p.m. and all plug their car in. That won't work. So we really need to start incentivizing charging when Australia's got cheap electricity, which is in the middle of the day. So then you've got to figure out where are the charges. The charges need to be where the cars are during the middle of the day. Some people are lucky enough to work from home, but we need them at schools, we need them at workplaces, we need them at the Bunnings and the Coles and the Woolies and the train stations and industry.
I'm going to facilitate, so can you not take any more questions?
Sorry, I didn't, yeah.
Because otherwise I could just go.
It wasn't, I'm sorry.
Because I've just seen you just set it off.
Plus I need to hand the microphone over. So.
But can I answer this one? Keep going. Yeah, I know. I'm just going to go back and come back to questions because I need to pass the microphone. That's the only reason we need to do this, so we can record it. And I'm going to go and stand up there. So I'll hand this over.
All right.
Okay, so now we can go back to taking questions. All right.
We live in Montmorency, which is kind of just over there, and it stunned me to learn, because I'm new to the area, that it's got a very low solar uptake. And then I thought, oh, well, you know, it's like this with all these hills and it's very canopy rich. And, you know, you don't get any feed-in tariff these days, so I'd like to explore with you the nuances around a community battery where rather than the power companies taking the extra when the battery's full, it could be donated. Either some sort of trust, community trust could be set up, and people who had an income below X, you could just choose to gift your extra solar to those households, or it went into a kind of pool. But it seems to me that there are some places with the topography and rental or whatever, who aren't going to have the arrays that we've got. And so to speed up the process, can we donate? Is there a community battery kind of movement?
There's so many good ideas in this question. It's hard to list. On the idea of community trust, so we have a Rewiring New Zealand, and they're actually setting up a. The Kiwis always do everything better and first. And so Rewiring New Zealand is setting up a trust to do exactly this and manage community batteries and community solar assets. It's a powerful idea for a few reasons. One of the things battery, there's a whole bunch of bottlenecks in getting electricity from the turbine all the way to your toaster. And if we place the batteries at the right places, we relieve those bottlenecks. Sometimes that's in the stove. So literally it's really expensive to run the high amp circuit for a stove. So especially in the US where they have lower voltage. So you can put a bit of a battery in the stove. The stove is constantly trickle charging. And then, so you can have an ordinary 10 or 15 amp wire, but you've got a really high performance stove, for example. The next bottleneck is on the side of your house, which is solved with the house battery. The next bottleneck is that wart on the top of every 50th pole, which is the distribution transformer. And that serves somewhere between 20 and 50 homes. But you'd like to have a battery underneath that. That, you know, community battery can mean many things. It can mean in the community, it can mean community ownership, and it is meaning all of those things right now, which means it means nothing in Australia. But if you were to say concisely, the highest portion of the electricity bill for most people is the cost of the local poles and wires. We are only using them at full capacity about 25 to 40% of the time. If we had batteries more equally distributed, including at that pole, including at the substation, some at the house, you'd be keeping all of the wires warm more often, and you should be able to get the utilization up to 50, maybe even 80%. If you do that, you will lower the largest portion of our electricity bill and make the price of electricity go down for everyone. So I think economically it's a good idea. I think progressively and socially it's a good idea. And I think the trust is one of the experiments worth running. It's hard to do in Australia right now. The Australian Energy Regulator doesn't, it's literally almost impossible to run a community battery in Australia with a tariff structure that does what you want to do. It turns out this ends up being a technical issue, a policy issue, and a social issue, which is why it's honestly why the government said it's easier to put them on the side of the house than do community batteries.
So I'll play devil's advocate. Do you think the community should be investing in batteries, or should the power companies be investing in distributed batteries to support the network better?
I believe if the Australian household was represented and a voting member of the regulatory agencies, and we had ombudsmen keeping an eye on it, it's probably logical that the local wires people own the batteries that are in the community, because they already maintain these things. They've got highly trained people to do it, and then they could just reflect it in the rates. So that's one possible outcome that I like. If you look at the numbers work right now for a community, but would I want every community to go invest in the battery knowing that that arbitrage gets lower over the next two decades as they just get everywhere? I'm not sure that I want communities and community groups to take the risk. So it's a very nuanced question about how do we get to the future we want from here, which is lower electricity bills, a ton more renewable, higher utilization of our network, and making sure that you bring the disadvantaged in the community along. And I think you can see three or four possible solutions. I think the most important thing is it really comes down to a relationship between the household and the DNSP. That's the local poles and wires people. But our electricity regulator regulates the generators and the transmission, and that ruins the politics of this. There's a natural partnership between the local wires people and the households, but the big heavy lobbyist that controls the system are the generators and the transmission people. Yeah.
You were talking about building reliability from the ground up rather than the top down. At a governmental basis, maybe rivaled by ACT, I don't know. South Australia's been very progressive in terms of increasing its renewable mix. How successful have they been in ensuring reliability of supply?
I might get the date wrong, but about 4 or 6 weeks ago, South Australia turned off one of their last two natural gas backup generators. So they're down to one gas generator. And really, they're just using that for the inertia, barely using it for any other reason. So that tells you how close we are to being able to do this without the traditional system strength. Part of that is because we put these synchrons out there, but the reality is Australia is going to be the first country in the world where we can go to 100% renewable all day with batteries and with inertia, either from synchronous generators above or from the inverters below. Technically, you know, if we were serious, we could be... This is the type of thing we wanted to do in 2515. We wanted it to be a bit more of a technical project that did this and said to the world, this is how it works. What we ended up doing is more of a social project, but, you know, with funding, and in fact, the government, to their credit, just did this grid enhancing technologies program, and lots of people applied to it. Someone in that set of people, maybe it'll be us, will get to do this, and you could have this running and proven in 12 to 18 months. Is that, did I give you the right answer? Did that answer the question? Or did I miss the question?
Yeah, it's a pretty good answer.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
There's a gentleman up the back.
Interesting that you mentioned bottlenecks. A significant bottleneck for us in our older houses around here is the switchboard.
Questions about switchboards?
Yeah, and the question is, where and why does it not get highlighted as being an issue, particularly for older houses, such as we have here? It's never mentioned.
Something we talk about.
I talk about it a lot. We're finding it's about 50% of homes, so it's not every home. It might be more in Victoria. But 40 or 50% of homes will eventually need a switchboard upgrade. That's the panel that connects you to the street that has all the circuits in it. Usually, you know, the second car charger you put in might trigger it, or the third battery, or the extra 5 kilowatts of solar you put on the garage. One of these things will trigger that upgrade. I have a friend, he actually rented my all-electric house in San Francisco. He runs a company called Span. He and a former employee of mine have just launched a new product which avoids the upgrade of the service. It's a $4,000 version of this thing that helps you deal with bringing on those new circuits. And that's just using electronic control to make sure that even though you've only got 100 amps to the house, if the cars and the stove and the hot tub all want to work at the same time, it just throttles them so you never go over the capacity. But it is an issue. When we were writing the Inflation Reduction Act, there was actually people were so aware of it, and we helped write this piece of the act. If you got any of the other rebates to get the car or the solar or the et cetera, it triggered an extra rebate to upgrade the main panel, because, you know, the people who know are highly aware this is a thing. I believe, you know, not only should we... I thought the battery rebate program designed by the government was clever. It used the same instrument as the solar tax credit, which is clever, so just to stir the market. I think we should use that to also underwrite the switchboard upgrades. We should also do that to help do electric vehicles. And thanks for bringing it up.
I've also been told that I have to have a new cable run to my house, which is an extra $3,000, if I want to get an electric hot water service. And I've been investigating this for the last 2 years, preempting what happened this week, which is my pilot light is just saying, I'm not going to work anymore. So I'm just wondering why that is, that this cable that is running to my house, which is 65 years old, it doesn't carry enough electricity for the switchboard even when you upgrade the switchboard.
So there's a certain rating for the wire that comes from the street, and it might be 60, 80, 100, 140 amps. Carl probably knows what they are, but they're different for different ages of houses that were built in different places at different times. And the conservative way that we judge whether your household can put extra current over there, it depends upon everything else. It's just that if you do the water heater, it's the first thing that takes you over the threshold. You should be able to solve that problem with a battery. So you just use that wire more often, store it in the battery, and the battery charges the water heater. That may or may not be cheaper than the $3,000 to upgrade the wire.
I'm just going to go back to the big picture, if that's right, because I know that people are asking really specific questions about their own homes, which is fantastic because it always showcases something that's coming up. But I'm just going to go back big picture and give you time to just reflect on the book a little bit more and about where we're going in terms of the kind of the politics of what you see happening in the next 10 years and particularly with regards to that wider context around, yes, we've got this energy transition happening at the same time as we've got, you know, a government that is sort of is signing off on new gas developments up in the north of Australia. We've got the US doing, God knows what the US is doing really, Sol, but I'm sure you can reflect on it and where it's going. How quickly, I mean, what's the role of this household transition going to play in that bigger energy debate that Australia's having at the moment around exports and export gas and export coal? And then what do you see happening in the US? What do you think, where do you see that playing out?
So the reason I've been advocating very heavily for the past 5+ years for the household energy transition, first and foremost, is because it's where the economics work. And so there's momentum. And we need to get any emission reduction we can as soon as we can to because remember, this is about the climate. So very strongly advocating for it because it works economically, it should be easy for the government to do, et cetera, et cetera. The big diabolical problem, and the reason the household economics works is because you pay, you know, Australian rooftop solar generates at 5 or 6 or 7 cents a kilowatt hour. Effectively, petrol costs you $1 a kilowatt hour. So it's a slam dunk. Natural gas is maybe 10 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour, and so if you've got that solar or if you've got a very high efficiency heat pump, that beats gas at the household. So the economics work there. Industry pays about one third of the price of gas, and they pay less for oil. And industry is actually gas's core business. And until probably just the last couple of years, these were called hard to decarbonize, and we couldn't even imagine how they would do it. This plays into global geopolitics in crazy ways. You can see the quiet partner in the Trump administration is the oil and gas industry, particularly natural gas. They have been party to this fever dream that we must beat China at AI because they're going to sell gas generators to power the AI. AI is just on the orders that OpenAI alone, Sam Altman, has made to AMD and NVIDIA. They're going to add 6% of the total electricity demand in America in the next 5 to 10 years. Literally half of the entire Australian electricity grid is their projected demand for one of the AI companies. And they're going to, and Trump administration wants that, you know, they've allowed this really hyperventilating, crazy idea that it's existential for us to beat China because it sells gas. I think the most indicative thing, the second or third day of the Trump administration, I don't know if I'm a bit of a tragic on US politics because I have to be, Secretary of State Marco Rubio meets his alternating partner from Russia at MBS's palace in Saudi Arabia. And at that meeting, I don't know if any of you remember it, said, look, this is how many trillions of dollars America would have made if instead of banning Russian gas, had have worked with the Russian oil and gas industry. It was just the most overwhelmingly positive indicator that this is a captured government by the oil and gas industry. The only surprise is Australia wasn't invited to that meeting because it was the three largest producers of oil and gas in the world and we're fourth. Thank God we weren't there. And then if you look at Trump's tariffs and you listen to the details, so Europe, we're going to give you this high 25% tariff, and then Europe promised to buy $750 billion worth of American natural gas, and the tariffs went down to 10%. And they are selling that deal with Alaskan LNG into Asia and et cetera, et cetera. So, like, this is hopefully the last spasm of the global gas industry, but this is what's driving a huge amount of the American politics. And, you know, if that's all centered and an economic activity in the US that's centered in Texas and Louisiana, like the red heartland. So Australia's playing that game too. We want to develop the Northwest Shelf because we believe it's existential for the country. It's our second and third, or two of our top three exports are LNG and metallurgical coal, which go to Asia to make steel and iron and all the stuff. And governments get rolled for two reasons, blackouts or losing tons and tons of jobs. So I think the government does what they think is reasonable, which is having a hedge bet on these LNG projects as the future of Australia. But there, that just means we have a lack of courage about what, you know, in the mid 20th century, we believed technology would come to rescue, and you invest in the technology and it will deliver. Just to give you a sense of where we are, I'm working with a group of old colleagues in the US. They can now make iron from Australian iron ore in a bucket of salty water at 90 degrees Celsius, at basically room temperature, at about two-thirds the energy cost of doing the same with coal or gas. If you could feed that 3 or 4 cents a kilowatt hour US renewables, you can make iron cheaper and zero emission. That is the price of renewables that you can get in South Australia today. So the good news is, and then I've got two friends in Boston, and they have similar processes for cement. Iron and cement are close to 20% of global emissions. They are the biggest emissions of industry. The next one after that is the plastics industry. But we now have a line of sight on beating natural gas in the international market for making iron, steel, and cement with Australian renewables. And I think that's really exciting, because if you can undercut natural gas at its core business, you make them uninvestable. So I'm a technologist, I'm an optimist. I don't always believe technology will save the day, but finally you can actually tell a story, and I can point at people and individuals who I know who have the technology that can beat gas straight up. Australia should bet all of our money on that, right? It's existential for Australia not to be able to make iron. If we do this right, we quadruple the value of our exports. We build a trading bloc with South Korea, Taiwan, Japan. Let's call it the Pacific Rim Trading Partnership. We should pull in California when they cleave off from the US.
That little golf up there, I just need
to... you have to have increasingly complicated stories to have any optimism for climate. And this sounds complicated, but I think it's pretty extraordinary that you can now say, you know, a couple of years ago, commercial sector, residential sector, transportation sector, we now know exactly what we need to do and how to get to zero, and it's going to save us money. We can now roughly see that that's also true for industry and even agriculture. So, like, the good news is China's done the heavy lifting. We've been doing a lot of the heavy lifting. Australia made 55% of the world's lithium last year. This is a good news story. Then it just boggles your mind why we are approving gas projects. And it also boggles my mind, quite frankly, given the economics are so good, why the Australian government isn't making it easier for everyone to do it. Like, hopefully we get COP next year. COP should have been announced for Australia immediately after Climate Week last week. It hasn't been. I'm a little bit worried that we might not get it. If we got COP, that's the United Nations Conference of the Parties. It would be in Adelaide. Adelaide is like where all of this greening of industry is going to start. It would have been an incredible story to show the world, and I think it would be a nice counter to the American narrative. But honestly, America's pissing everyone off, so... just a bit.
I'm going to wrap up with one more question. We've only got a couple more minutes, so I'm going to ask you just for a bit of fun so that we can end on a bit of a light note.
That was light? That's like we got the future is savable.
I mean, that was optimistic. That was heavy and optimistic. I liked that.
The light note is, what are some of the fun things that you're electrifying at your place?
Oh, my Lord, everything. Just finished electrifying a 1966 Vespa with a sidecar, little motor scooter. I got a cattle dog who refuses to sit in the sidecar, but when he does, it's going to be so photogenic that it'll save the world. I'm building...
So is it going to be better than this, though,
so much better than that. I promised both kids I'd electrify a car with them. I gave them the choice of any car that we could find used real cheap. And my son chose a 1964 E.H. Holden station wagon. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's that beautiful blue colour with the white roof. It even has the Venetian blinds in the back. So we're just finishing the garage. Hopefully Carl will help me put solar panels on the garage so that we can... the welder we use to fix that car and electrify it will be run off Australian sunshine. I'm building an electric jet boat, actually with a Kiwi friend. He's into building electric jet boats. They're just extraordinary. And I'm electrifying. I've got an outrigger canoe, I want to paddle more, but I want to get out deeper because I want to catch the tuna that swim by Wollongong. So I'm putting an electric assist on my outrigger canoe so I can do all electric zero emission fishing.
You're in danger though, don't you? I'm just joking.
we'll get Benito. Anyway, so all electric zero carbon fish. Yeah, it's a party at my house.
It's all happening at your place.
Yeah.
Thank you, Sol. That's a lot of fun. All right, I'm just going to quickly wrap that up. Thank you so much for all of your questions. I'm sorry, there were so many of them, and I'm sure there's going to be plenty of other places where you're going to be able to ask those questions. I know that there's a lot of community organisations that actually run events around electrification and around getting off gas, including my Ours Renew, including Clean Energy Nillumbik, which Natalie is going to come and speak to you about. But before we do that, I'd like you to put your hands together for Sol, please. Thank you.